Welcome to CERT's podcast series, Security for Business Leaders. The CERT program is part of the Software Engineering Institute, a federally funded research and development center at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You can find out more about us at CERT.org. Show notes for today's conversation are available at the podcast website. My name is Julia Allen. I'm a principal researcher at CERT working on operational resilience. I'm very pleased today to welcome back Jean Kim. Jean is a founder and former CTO with Tripwire. And today, Jean and I will be discussing some great research he's been doing over the past decade or so into the unique behaviors of high-performing IT and security organizations, including some real notaries like Netflix, LinkedIn, Google, Amazon, and Etsy. And Gene and his two co-authors have illustrated these ideas in story form in a recent novel about IT Ops and DevOps, Development and Operations, titled The Phoenix Project, a novel about IT DevOps and helping your business win. And so we've also discussed some of Gene's foundational work in two previous podcasts, and I'll link to those when we post our show notes. But with no further ado, welcome, Jean. It's really good to have you back on the podcast series.
Oh, my gosh, Julie, I'm so delighted to be back. And I want everyone to know that Julie is one of my favorite people on the planet and has influenced my work probably more than anyone. So thank you so much, Julie.
I appreciate those kind words, Jean. You've got a great value network, so I appreciate being included in your circle. So I had the good fortune to hear you speak about this what I consider to be groundbreaking work in a recent presentation you gave. So let's kind of use that as our structure. So during that talk, you stated that every company is an IT company. So from the point of view of your work, what does this really mean, and why is it so challenging for most organizations?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's one of the motivations why we wrote the Phoenix Project was this thing that we kept on hearing from organizations saying that, you know, we're not Google, we're not Etsy, you know, so IT doesn't have to be a core competency. And yet when you look at the numbers, something startling shows up is that 95% of all capital projects have a technology component, and 50% of all capital spending is technology related. So, you know, it means that, I think most people would say technology is the nervous system of the company, but it turns out that technology is actually the majority of the muscle mass as well. And whenever you have the organization saying, here's where we are and here's where we need to get to, you know, who's in the way? It's IT. And often if you go into the IT box, it's IT operations. That has two implications. One is that, IT's always, it appears to be in the way of the goals and aspirations of the organization. And secondly, not only is it impeding kind of the project work, but it's difficult to balance, time to market needs to deliver new capabilities to the market, and the opposite, which is how to deliver reliable, stable, secure IT service. For decades, we've thought that it's impossible to get both. In other words, you can't have fast feature flows into market while preserving stability and reliability. And I think the biggest aha moment, and the reason why I'm so excited to be a part of the DevOps movement, is that, there's a pattern of behaviors that we're now calling DevOps, where you can actually get astounding feature flow, hundreds or thousands of changes per day, while achieving world-class security and reliabilities. And these are the practices that make, the modern internet companies run, whether it's Google, LinkedIn, Twitter, Netflix. It's increasingly being adopted by enterprises as well. And I think it's probably going to become one of the most important competencies for organizations, and it has a huge implication for information security.
Right, so we're going to talk about that in a little bit, but let's stay with the pain point a little for another moment or two. So you talk about this core conflict between putting more products and services out faster and also then in the face of that constant churn and constant change, providing a stable, secure, foundational infrastructure within which all these new capabilities can operate. And you characterize this as a downward spiral because it just seems like one thing, it's a domino effect. One thing happens and it exacerbates something else. And so what do you see as you've worked with different types of organizations as the behaviors and conflicts that and actions that contribute to this downward spiral?
Yeah. it's sort of like in the movie Sixth Sense. Once you start seeing the dead bodies, you start seeing them everywhere. And so literally, here's the thumbnail of the downward spiral, and it typically starts in IT operations, whereas IT operations, our mission is to provide reliable, stable, and secure service to the customer. But the problem is that so many of the assets that it relies upon for functionality are fragile. And so we call them fragile because every time we touch something, whether we try to patch it or deploy a change or do a rollout, it blows up, and often catastrophically, and causes a huge amount of unplanned work for operations. And the tragedy is that, you know, where you find the most fragile artifacts are, you know, in the most critical business operations of the company or in the most critical business initiatives, so both on the operations and project side. And so when you have the most important business initiatives and business operations relying on something that's fragile, you know, the consequence is that the organization becomes unable to meet the commitments it makes to the market, to the outside world, whether it's, you know, features promised to customers or earnings per share estimates, you know, to Wall Street, or promises, you know, about strategy and execution to analysts. And so I think a part of human nature, and anyone I think who's been married, you know, can probably resonate with, is that, you know, the way we compensate for missing our promises is to make even bigger, more audacious promises. And so, you know, when that happens, you know, commitments are made to the outside world, and now development sees urgent, date-driven projects put into the queue where a commitment has been made and a date has already been set. And so now, developers, we have to cut at whatever corner is required in order to hit the date. And so I think that has two consequences. One is that we focus only on the features as opposed to the non-functional requirements of, like, reliability, stability, security. The second one is that we use up all the time in the schedule, leaving no time for the downstream work centers like QA, capacity testing, deployment, information security, operations. And so it means that at the end of every one of these projects, we have one more piece of fragile infrastructure in production. So that's one downward spiral. But there's actually one more more insidious downward spiral, which is that, you know, as we accrue more and more technical debt, deployments start taking longer. So the act of deployment, you know, might take in the beginning like a minute or 5 minutes, but then it starts taking an hour, starts taking 2 hours, starts taking a day, starts taking 2 days. You know, I've seen even deployments take 6 weeks. You know, we estimated it took about 1,300 steps. And so when this is happening, no one is achieving their goals. Features like aren't getting to market. Deployments are taking longer. We're getting more and more fragile artifacts. And now we're spending all our time firefighting. We're spending more of our time in unplanned work, which is actually starving the entire organization to actually do more planned work to eradicate technical debt, to reduce the surface area of risk for information security vulnerabilities. And so, you know, once this happens, you know, the organization becomes less and less able to not only make good on the promises it makes, but also to survive as an organization. And I think most people will resonate with some elements of the story. And I think the tragic part is that it happens everywhere.
Right, and I'm, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, this. I have this vision of this snowball effect, and it just kind of gets bigger and bigger and more looming and more looming. And like you said, we keep making commitments that we can't keep, which only exacerbates the situation. But what I'd really like to spend a little bit of time on, I'm so glad you mentioned it, is with this constant focus on features, there's very little, if any, time left for all the quality attributes that surround the product. So given this is a security podcast, can you say a little bit about why this behavior and why this phenomenon that you've observed is relevant for information security? How does it affect them?
Yeah, and Julie, I have to say, I mean, it's so delightful to me. I mean, that we find ourselves again in the same sort of research area of, like, how do we sort of turn security into all the attributes, like everything else, right? In terms of non-functional requirement. But I think as a information security practitioner and as a vocation, you know, this downward spiral actually hits us worst of all because we're the
there's no time left, right?
Right. We're the very last step when people include us, if they include us at all, we're going to come at the very end, right? Which, right or wrong, that this is what happens. And two is that means that the buffet table is empty, you know, by the time we get around to it. And because that we're, I think more than most functional areas, information security is often pushed to the margins, you know, because we have a reputation of slowing things down. We have a reputation of blowing up the, the project due dates and the cost. And so, you know, I think we've created a learned behavior where the only way to get things done quickly, right, is to bypass security. So even when we're involved, right, we come at the empty, at the, we get engaged so late that there's no time to make a meaningful difference in outcomes. But, and I think the consequence of that is that as information security practitioners, we now get relegated to the role of compliance. So literally our goal is to get all the boxes checked, you know, that were given to us from, you know, whether it's the regulators or the, you know, external auditors or the certification, the CNA folks. So, you know, I think for me, that's very interesting, right? Because at this point, you know, we're not making the organizations more secure, right? The only thing we're doing is not helping the organization achieve its goals. We're actually just trying to make an external third party happier. A friend of mine, Josh Corman, he's a security researcher. I mean, he did a study of burnout in the information security industry, and the shocking finding was that the levels of burnout in InfoSec are actually higher than first responders, physicians in the emergency room, you know, people doing multiple tours of duty in the military. And I think, you know, and the three signs of burnout are fatigue, cynicism.
Right.
Josh would say cynicism is our core competency. And the, you know, third one is illusions of self-efficacy. So we as a profession think that we're actually better than we are. And so I think this is what happens when you have, you know, when you live downstream and you have to live the consequences of decisions made far upstream. And I think, you know, I would just love to repeat the study to not only include just InfoSec, but also IT operations as well. I think anyone who's downstream, you know, having to live with compounding technical debt because of decisions made upstream that have to live with it on a daily basis, I think you're going to see these characteristics. And that's not great for, you know, the individual. It's not great for the profession. And it's certainly not good for the organization.
Right, and not great for the product. So, okay,
right.
So I think you've painted a very challenging picture of, you know, what you've observed as the current state in a lot of organizations. So let's start discussing.
Actually, can I add one more thing?
Go ahead.
So I think the benefits, on the other hand, of a DevOps-style workflow is that what we really want to be so excited about DevOps for information security is that, you know, here finally is a way that we can get integrated into that daily work of both development and operations. And, you know, I think there are now an ever-growing number of case studies that are really showing that the cultural norms in a DevOps work stream is so consistent with what we want as information security practitioners. You know, they want to focus on not just feature delivery rates, but also, you know, quality, scalability, deployability, manageability, security, visibility,
right. Defect and vulnerability reduction, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that also is a huge benefit is, you know, the reduced cycle time. So when you're talking about doing, you know, tens, hundreds, or thousands of deploys a day, you know, it means that the time from vulnerability detection to vulnerability fixed generated, the vulnerability fixed deployed, should be very, very short, right? We don't have to wait for that change window 9 months from now, right? So this, I think, is inherently changes the working relationship between InfoSec and the other functional areas such as development and operations.
Great. And I'm interested in exploring that with you further, because we've known for a long time that we need to address security earlier in the life cycle, but we've had a hard time getting uptake on that. And I think with DevOps, you know, we really have an opportunity, and I'm sure you've seen many instances of making that so. So let's talk about one. One of the examples that you cite, and granted, this is kind of their core competence, so it may be difficult for a lot of smaller organizations to identify this, but you identify Amazon and what they've done as an example of a better way that takes advantage of the ideas in DevOps. So can you say a little bit about Amazon and some of their deployment statistics?
Yeah, there was a seminal presentation that I think really kicked the DevOps movement off in 2009. John Allspaugh, he was the head of operations at Flickr, and Paul Hammond was the director of engineering at Yahoo. And, you know, their sort of startling presentation was that they are routinely doing 10 deploys a day, every day. And, Julie, one of the things that you taught me when studying high performers is that the best always get better, you know, that the best always accelerate away from the herd. And to see the acceleration in deployment rates is just, in my mind, breathtaking. John Jenkins at Amazon, he, at the Velocity Conference last year, went on record saying that they are now doing one deploy every 11 seconds. So that, what is a deploy? A deploy is, what is ever in the trunk of the source code repository is actually what's in production. So this is an extension of, continuous builds, continuous tests, continuous integration into something we call continuous delivery. So, that means, code and infrastructure is being deployed at a rate of once every 11 seconds. And so that's a mean number of deploys of 22,000 per day. So that can be a small.
I mean, it's hard to even conceive of what that means, right?
It's a standard, right? So, in contrast, right, like most organizations have one deployment and release every year, right? So, that's, four orders of magnitude difference? What a deployment could be is it could be as small as a content change on the website. It could be a deployment of a new A/B feature test. It could be as large as, thousands of new environments going up, being deployed behind a load balancer. So, these are small changes and large changes. I think one of the big aha moments for me was, when realizing that I was often conflating deployments from releases or prerequisites. Deployment rates is that you are having developers check in once per day. And so this often means that features are being deployed into production in a disabled state. This is as opposed to waiting until the very end of the project release to actually do the integration, the full feature testing, so now what happens when you do that is that we are now combining the deployment risk, the inherent risk of making a change into production, which is one big batch of changes, and the release risk, right, is that we're doing it when it matters most, on the day that we promised, the feature to the market. So in this state, right, we have like an Operation Desert Shield, right? It's a year-long project where thousands of meta materials are being put into place, but we have one release event. And I think to separate deployment and release is just a wonderful thing because now development and operations can be held responsible for the deployment risk. Right, the release risk, we can now hold marketing responsible for, did that business hypothesis actually pan out? Did that feature achieve the desired result? And one last comment, Julie, is that now suddenly, like if there's a sudden fix, vulnerability, if we can develop a fix, chances are we can get it into production, in hours or days, as opposed to having to, play that, shoots and ladders game of trying to get all the plans aligned, to find a 10-minute window to shove it into production.
Right. Well, let's talk about the DevOps approach a little bit, and sometimes you call it rugged DevOps when you add security considerations. So could you take us through, you talk about different ways of thinking, the first way, the second way, the third way, and you kind of, I know in your presentation, you walk through a structure of different perspectives and actions that are required to actually make this approach start to have some traction. So could you just start to walk us through that, and I'll interject from time to time?
Yeah. So in the Phoenix project, this is closely modeled after the book The Goal, which is what Julie, this is actually one of my favorite books that influenced me so strongly.
Right, by Eliel Goldratt.
Yes, the late Dr. Goldratt, and they both feature a Yoda-like character who kind of speaks in gnomic, enigmatic ways, and so the language that our Yoda talks in is the language of the three ways, which are the set of principles that we believe you actually derive almost all the DevOps patterns from. And so the first way is a way of flow. And so it's the flow from work as you go from left to right, from development into operations. And so why Dev and Ops? Because Dev and Ops are what's in between the business and the customer. So when the business says, here's where we need to go, right, that gets translated into work in dev, that must successfully transition into service, into operations. And then and only then have we actually delivered value to the customer. And so, the goal is always to, accelerate flow. So like in manufacturing, the goal, according to Mike Rother, who wrote the book Toyota Kata, the most important metric, for performance is lead time. How long does it take to go from, raw materials to finished goods? The principles behind the first way are, understanding the flow of work, the notion that work should flow quickly in one direction. It shouldn't ping pong back and forth, between dev and ops and, heaven forbid, right? It shouldn't, be caught by InfoSec who wants to drag it all the way back to the beginning, right? It should be smooth flow. The second, principle would be, the need to accelerate flow. So in the DevOps community, I think our favorite metric typically tends to be, you know, the cycle time. In other words, how many releases do we do, deploys do we do a day? But again, I think the most important metric is lead time. And the metric I love to look at is, you know, how long does it take to go from code committed to code successfully running in production? And we now know that from the benchmarking, I worked with an organization called Puppet Labs. We benchmarked 4,200 organizations, and we found that, you know, the high performers, the lead time is measured in minutes or hours, whereas non-high performance, the mean is somewhere between months and quarters.
Wow, what a difference.
Exactly. And, you know, interestingly enough, not only is they're deploying code 30 times more quickly, the lead time is much shorter, but they're getting far better outcomes. You know, they have
You're talking about in terms of more stability, less disruption from the changes that just got introduced, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Twice the change success rates. And when the changes fail, because Murphy does exist, you know, the mean time to repair for those 7-1 incidents is 12 times shorter. So, I mean, it's just stunning evidence that you can actually get both stability and agility. It's not numbers. Like, these high performers are outperforming in both agility and stability.
Gene, why don't we move to the second perspective, where we talk about kind of the right to left, how we get feedback going from the actual operations side of the house back into development. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the the concrete outcomes that in order to achieve the first way is having ops and security work together to make environments available on demand. So that means that, you know, whenever someone wants an environment, whether it's developers or testers, you know, they can get one with one click, and that's an automated process. You don't have to open up a ticket. You don't have to wait 42 weeks, right? That's available to anybody. And I think that one thing we found in the benchmarking is one of the behaviors that was almost universally present in every one of the high performers. I think the second way, whereas the first way was all about flow from left to right, the second way is all about feedback from right to left. So how do we take those key learnings that we learn only in the failure modes in operation in InfoSec, and we get that fed back earlier in the line? I think achieving one of the things that we've always aspired to do is InfoSec. You know, how do we get those things designed in and create quality at the source? So the principles in the second way are shortening and amplifying feedback loops. Oh my goodness, I think it was you and Eileen Forrester who taught me that, right? At the heart of every process improvement methodology is this desire to shorten and amplify feedback loops. And secondly is really create the capabilities and knowledge where we need it. And I think, you know, the best example, the paragon of this behavior is like the Toyota Andon cord, where at the top of every work center, every is a cord that every employee is empowered and expected to pull the cord whenever we deviate from the, you know, expected behavior. So if a part isn't there, if the part is defective, if the work takes longer than specified, we pull the cord, which actually stops the entire production line. So trucks no longer come out the other end. A friend showed me this article that in the Alabama plant, the Andon cord is pulled 3,000 times per day. So,
wow.
You know, I think it's just astounding. And so kind of as InfoSec practitioners, how many times do we see something in a given day where we really think, man, we think that, or suspect that the right thing to do is actually to stop the line? And I think in a DevOps work stream, that's not only acceptable, that's demanded. And I think the DevOps pattern that I just love so much in the second way are this notion of waking developers up at 2 a.m. There's this wonderful quote from Patrick Lightbody. He was the founder of a company called BrowserMob. He said, we found that when we woke up developers at 2 a.m., defects got fixed faster than ever.
Sure.
I think this is so wonderful because it says, you know, it's shared pain, and you need to have shared pain in order to have really shared goals. And as opposed to the functional silos saying, it's not my problem, you know, for devs to just throw it over the wall and have ops and security live with the consequences, having dev live with daily consequences, you know, about decisions made upstream, I think is absolutely required to get these kind of amazing outcomes like increased stability while improving agility.
Well, yeah, and some of the comments that you made that really resonated for me is have developers develop in an instance of the production environment. When they throw the code into operational deployment, have them be responsible for maintaining their own service. So actually put developers into what is typically an IT ops role, and as you said, let them feel some of the pain. Let them be called at 2 o'clock in the morning. Let them really see what it's like to receive some of the code that they've developed downstream and have to deal with it, right?
Yeah, exactly right. In fact, I just saw this quote from Werner Vogel. He's the CTO at Amazon, and he said, "Yeah, it goes beyond just that." He said it also gets developers closer to the customer, which is actually another one of these important things to increase feedback. Right? Is that now developers can see the entire value stream, and the ones that matter the most. Not only just the downstream customer, the internal customer, but also the external customer as well.
Right. Well, Gene, we're coming up on time, and I certainly don't want to give short shrift to the third way, which is really what makes this stuff all stick, makes it all be part of the way that the organization does business as part of the culture. So can you say a little bit about this cultural dimension of experimentation and learning and pulling the cord when something needs to be done? Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, the first way is flow. The second way is feedback. And the third way is this creating a culture that I think does two things. One is, this demand that everybody has to take risks, try new things, learn from successes and failures. And I think this is so, I don't want to say synonymous, but I mean, there's so many movements right now, whether it's the Jim Collins, choosing to be great, whether it's Eric Ries's this lean startup, whether it's Scott Cook, the founder of Intuit, his rampant innovation culture, this notion of learning from failure, constant experimentation. And I think they talk about it a lot from the business side, but I think it applies just as much, if not more, to the IT value stream as well. And so to give a concrete example, just because we've had the same software development lifecycle process, the same security testing schedule, the same change management processes for the last 20, 30 years, doesn't mean that we shouldn't be afraid to change them as long as we understand the goals, right? And, you can't achieve goals without understanding risks. So, I think, if we understand what the global goals are, right, there has to be this culture that says, be allowed and expected to experiment. And the second piece of this is that, in order to do this safely, we have to understand the link between repetition as a prerequisite to mastery. I just love this emerging school of thought of saying whether it's learning to play a musical instrument or special forces training in the military or training a sports team. It's always better to practice 15 minutes a day than it is to practice every day. So it's always better to practice 15 minutes a day every day than it is to practice once a week for 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the example that comes to mind is like the annual security pen test. It's like we have this ritual we go through where we tell everybody, that the pen tests are coming, right? We get scheduled in the time slot, and we have this theater that we're going to actually pretend, that we're going to improve anything, right? Whereas really what we want is something more like what Netflix does with Chaos Monkey, where, they were the only organization to survive the large-scale Amazon EC2 failures in 2011. And when everyone asks why were they the only organization that survived and what were they doing differently, one of the things that they talked about was a design decision that they made that said, because we can never depend on Amazon for availability, because they will never be there when we need them most, we made the decision that in order to survive failure, we had to fail all the time. And so they unveiled Chaos Monkey, which, they described as running on every production server in the cloud, which randomly kills processes and entire compute instances. And they do this in production all the time, large-scale fault injection in production. And so, you talk about a way that creates a more resilient code, resilient infrastructure, and resilient organization. I mean, that's it, right? I think that's the opposite of this annual theater event that we have called security pen testing. And I think, the benefits of that to InfoSec are just huge.
Right. In other words, you actually make failure, regular failure, small, medium, and large-scale failure a part of everyday operations. And so you develop a culture and a set of skills and competencies in your staff and a robustness in your system assets that, that just expects that that is the norm. And it turns out that is the norm, right?
Right. Exactly. Which I think this is what I find just so wonderful about kind of where our work is overlapping yet again is this notion of like, you know, these are the attributes of resilient organizations. You can't get good, you can't get resilient if there's not some element of constant adversity.
Right. Well, listen, Gene, I know we've barely scratched the surface, and there are so many rich and robust concepts in the work that you've done that I hope our listeners are intrigued enough by our short conversation today to go pursue this topic further. So do you have some places where our listeners can learn more?
There's a reading list that we put together around the Phoenix Project book, that's through the blog post called Learn More About the Concepts in the Phoenix Project. That's part one of at least two or three that's written. That's one resource. There's another presentation, and that's at the ITRevolution.com site. The second one is what I think is one of the best InfoSec presentations I've seen in, at least 5 years. And that was how the Twitter InfoSec team, what they did to create more secure applications and operations after the Barack Obama account was hacked and they got slapped with an FTC injunction to have a security program for the next 25 years. Presentation is from the team that made that happen, which I think is amazing and just showing how much they're influencing and integrating into the daily work of development. And I think it's just magnificent. And in my mind, 10 years from now, this will be the way every information security is going to be operating. And I think the third resource that I would point people to is, you know, if people are interested in, you know, a description of the downward spiral and a story of how does the transformation look like, the Phoenix Project, we're making available for free the first half of the book. So I'll give a link there. If you put in your email address, we'll send you a PDF file. And, you know, that's really designed to be shared. I think one of the researchers have shown over and over that the most effective mode of persuasion, right, and mobilization is storytelling. And so the book is really designed to show the downward spiral and the reaction. I think just like one of the most gratifying things of the journey is that we're getting so many comments, just like Dr. Goldratt did, is that, you know, he got so many letters that said, you have described our plan, you've described our characters, you know, you've been hiding our plan for the last 6 months. we're getting those same sort of comments. And I think, you know, it's a way, in order to transform like this, you have to have fellow stakeholders in development and operations. And so the book is really designed to create empathy and shared pain, showing that we're all in this together, right? And there's actually a bigger problem that needs to be solved. And so I'm hoping that the excerpt will be used as a way to find those fellow travelers and those other people required to create the coalition to make DevOps transformations happen, because I think it's urgent and important.
Excellent, Gene. Well, thank you. I can't thank you enough for your time, for your preparation, for this incredible body of work that you've committed your professional life to. You mentioned you kudos at the top of the call to me, but I'd like to say to you, it's been my pleasure to work with you and collaborate with you and to move this whole conversation forward. So thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, no, thank you, Julie, and I'm looking forward to the next one.